Montana continues to have a higher-than-average sign-up rate for Obamacare. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about another avalanche death, this time a snowmobiler. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with historian Andrew Basevich about why he thinks the military needs to be more accountable. The number of Montanans applying for health insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act continues to climb. Residents signed up for about 4,000 plans on the state's online Obamacare marketplace in the month of February. That makes nearly 23,000 plans since the marketplace opened last fall. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the rate of signups sits above the national average.
59-year-old Luke Hallberg is walking out of the offices of the Montana Health Co-op in Helena. That's one of the three companies that sells insurance plans through Montana's Affordable Care Act marketplace.
Looking at the paperwork, it says I had to pay by the 15th or I'm doomed.
He's trying to get signed up for coverage by the 15th of this month to have coverage start April 1st. Kohlberg has been unemployed for about 6 years, living off the income from some investments. He falls into the gap created when the Montana legislature opted not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. He makes too much to qualify for Medicaid as it stands, but not enough to be eligible for subsidies on the exchange.
I spent numerous days on the internet and I wanted to have some questions answered.
The Obamacare online marketplace website had a disastrous rollout last fall. And inside the health co-op, Chief External Affairs Officer Rick Yeary says his business is still having problems with the site, especially when it comes to signing up low-income Montanans who may not have a credit history or email address.
It just takes a long time to enroll. It's confusing to a lot of folks on what they need to do to actually get a policy up.
Still, he says the co-op has had a steady stream of people signing up. And statewide, the rate of signups is almost a percentage point higher than the rate nationwide. About 2.25% in Montana, about 1.3% for the U.S. as a whole.
It's not an insignificant chunk of people.
That's Jennifer McKee. She's the communications director for the State Commissioner of Securities and Insurance. She says it's not the role of the commissioner's office to cheerlead for Obamacare or tear it down. And the office has not been all positive about the implementation of the law in the past. But McKee says the nearly 23,000 policies sold does not equal how many people are now covered under the law. A policy could cover a whole family, for instance.
So the whole picture of how well Obamacare is or is not doing in Montana is still being developed at this point.
The Montana Republican Party is still arguing for the full repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Executive Director Bowen Greenwood says more health insurance plans have been canceled because of the law than have been created through it. It's not exactly clear if that's the case, but it's arguable. And he says it's from the new requirements placed on insurance plans.
Those additional services drove up the cost quite a bit, and a lot of folks found that their health insurance plans, which they had used for a long time, were suddenly discontinued.
But back at the Montana Health Co-op, 59-year-old Luke Hallberg has some new peace of mind. He now has health insurance for the first time in 5 years. It's catastrophic coverage, meaning it will only come into play if he gets really hurt.
This is like the bronze plan, which is going to have to be good enough for now.
But it will only cost him less than $5 a month. Yet, to make enough income to qualify for the subsidy to make the plan that cheap, he has to sell one of his old cars. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, officials in southwestern Montana say an 18-year-old Minnesota man has died after he was buried in an avalanche while snowmobiling. The Park County Sheriff's Office says it received a report of a snowmobiler buried in the Daisy Pass and Crown Butte area near Cook City about 4 last night. The victim from Lake Lillian, Minnesota, was found under about 6 feet of snow shortly after 5 p.m. His name hasn't been released. Undersheriff Scott Hamilton says the victim was with a group of 6 others. One other member of the party was knocked off his snowmobile but was not buried. He was slightly injured. The man is the 5th Montana avalanche victim since January 1st. The Colorado Avalanche Information Center says 23 people have died in avalanches nationwide since December 26th.
Officials have identified the woman who shot and killed herself on Mullen Road in Missoula yesterday as 37-year-old Erin Rosalie Norden. Norden shot herself after being involved in a minor traffic accident near Mullen and Reserve Street. Officials had to break into her car to try to render aid, but she died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
Federal officials say a United Airlines flight from Denver to Billings likely encountered severe clean air turbulence over Wyoming, causing a sudden loss of altitude that injured 11 of the 114 people on board. A report from the National Transportation Safety Board says the Boeing 737-700 sustained minor damage in this February 17th incident, but continued for an uneventful landing. Two people were seriously injured, including a flight attendant who remained hospitalized for several days. Nine people reported minor injuries, including a lap-held infant whose passengers said was wrenched from a parent's hold as the plane lurched violently while traveling at an altitude of 34,000 feet. Clear weather was reported at the time of the event. The Billings Gazette reports United has since returned the plane to service.
The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes are asking a federal judge to block two state courts from deciding on water rights on the Flathead Reservation. A state district court in Lake County and the Montana Water Court are considering three lawsuits filed by non-Indians who are claiming personal water rights there. The tribes say in their February 27th lawsuit that federal treaties and laws dating from 1855 established their rights to all the water on and flowing through the reservation. They are asking the federal court to block the judges in the state lawsuits from determining who owns the water rights. The tribes say Congress has specified the only way a non-Indian can acquire a water right on the reservation, and state courts do not have jurisdiction over those claims.
Federal lawmakers from states along the Upper Missouri River are asking the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to disclose the steps it's taking to prepare for potential spring floods. Mountain snowpack levels in the Missouri River Basin so far this season are comparable to 2011, when flooding devastated hundreds of thousands of acres of mostly farmland across the Midwest. Today, members of Congress from Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota asked Army Corps Brigadier General John Kemm what infrastructure repairs and improvements have been made in the years since. Lawmakers also want to know how the Corps is managing a network of major reservoirs along the Missouri River to limit the flood threat. April, May, and June historically are some of the wettest months in the basin.
The chairman and CEO of the Spokane-based Potlatch Corporation is in Missoula to deliver the annual Gilkey Lecture at the University of Montana. Mike Covey is a UM forestry graduate who worked for Plum Creek Timber Company for over 20 years before joining Potlatch in 2005. Both companies in recent years have sold some of their timberland for real estate development. Covey says that's part of the company's way to stay in business.
I think there's just no way that we can grow and compete and buy more timberland if we don't consider the fact that in any large block of timberland, there are going to be components that have more valuable uses than growing trees. And in order to compete for that land and own it and to provide a return to our shareholders, we have to consider that in the equation.
We'll have a feature interview with Covey tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
A man who chained himself to a cement-filled drum to protest the slaughter of bison migrating from the Yellowstone National Park is facing federal charges in Wyoming. 20-year-old Comfrey Jacobs is scheduled to be arraigned April 2nd on charges of disorderly conduct, entering a closed area, and interference. Jacobs lives in Colorado but has been residing in West Yellowstone. Court documents indicate prosecutors will not be seeking jail time in the case. Jacobs chained himself to the 50-gallon drum and blocked the road to the Stevens Creek Corrals near the park border on March 6th. Park officials were holding bison in the corrals to await shipment for slaughter. More than 250 bison were slaughtered this winter as part of government efforts to reduce the size of Yellowstone's bison herds.
A Montana man and his girlfriend have denied charges they gave the man's 2-year-old son marijuana and allowed him to smoke it. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports Lucas Keith Wilson appeared in district court on Monday and Camilla Rose Samuels was in court yesterday. Both pleaded not guilty to felony and misdemeanor charges of endangering the welfare of a child. Prosecutors say the Bozeman couple let Wilson's 2-year-old son smoke marijuana while the family was staying in a tent at a campground. Prosecutors say both Wilson and Samuels told investigators they let the boy smoke marijuana 5 times since August. Wilson said it would make the boy mellow. Charging documents say the couple recently had a baby that tested positive for marijuana and meth when he was born. Wilson remained jailed today with his bail set at $50,000.
A former Missoula physician's assistant has been sentenced to 2.5 years in federal prison in a case in which prosecutors alleged she prescribed large amounts of narcotic painkillers to people she knew or believed were addicts or dealers. Kelly R. Etzel of Lolo was sentenced on March 6th by U.S. District Judge Dana Christensen in Missoula. Etzel was indicted last August on 11 counts of distribution of controlled substances. She pleaded guilty on 2 counts in December. Prosecutors allege she prescribed hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, and hydromorphone to patients at First Choice Clinic without giving proper exams. Etzels also lost her physician assistant certification. Defense attorney Paul Ryan sought a sentence of home confinement so Etzel could care for her developmentally delayed son and her father, who has terminal cancer.
A Lake County jailer has been suspended with pay after officers broke up an underage drinking party at his residence. Sheriff J. Doyle suspended the officer yesterday, hours after police responded to a noise complaint at the jailer's house and found, quote, a number of underage intoxicated drinkers. An internal investigation is ongoing, and the officer's name is not being released until criminal charges are filed.
A Kalispell man has denied a charge that alleges he took $136,000 from a man he was taking care of. The Daily Interlake reports 66-year-old Jack Roll pleaded not guilty to felony theft last Thursday during a hearing in district court in Kalispell. Prosecutors say the victim's children hired Roll to care for their father for $1,500 per month. As part of the job, Roll had access to the man's bank accounts. Court records say an audit determined $136,000 went missing from the man's account over a three-year period during which Roll worked for him. Investigators say Roll admitted he withdrew the money to gamble. Roll's next hearing is set for April 9th.
Zoo Montana officials say the zoo's 18-year-old Siberian tiger has died, likely due to complications from cancer. Executive Director Jeff Ewelt tells the Billings Gazette that staffers are devastated over the death of Prince, who had lived at the zoo for a decade. 2 weeks ago, zoo staff noticed Prince was limping. When medications didn't help, they put him under anesthesia yesterday for an exam. X-rays showed Prince was suffering from significant bone cancer. Ewelt says Prince died after suffering breathing problems while recovering from the anesthesia. The cancer had already spread to his lungs. After further examination, zoo officials believe the tiger only had a few weeks left to live. The average lifespan for an Amur, or Siberian tiger, is about 14 years in the wild and 20 in captivity.
A critic of American military intervention is in Missoula to deliver a talk in the president's lecture series at the University of Montana. Andrew Basevich is a retired Army colonel, author, and historian who teaches international relations and history at Boston University. In this feature interview, Basevich talks with news director Sally Mock about what he calls the, quote, new American militarism.
I'm of the baby boomer generation, and in many respects, the central chapter of my own life was the Vietnam War, and it's certainly the case.
Which you served in.
Yes. It's certainly the case that during the Vietnam War, and as a consequence of the Vietnam War, Americans back, let's say, in the 70s did not have a romanticized view of their military, did not have a romanticized view of war.
Quite the contrary.
Quite the contrary. But what occurred in the wake of the Vietnam War, at least in the story that that I tell, is it that changed radically, that a number of groups and institutions of varying levels of influence came to see the revival of military power and the celebration of martial virtues as essential to restoring American life more broadly. Or to put it another way, these were groups, institutions that viewed the changes in America attributed to the 1960s as disastrous, and they wanted to overturn those changes, and they saw the military as the means with which by which to achieve that.
When you say they, who are you referring to?
I'm referring to, first of all, the officer corps itself, the officer corps of which I was then a member, which, of course, had suffered a tremendous defeat in Vietnam. As a consequence of that defeat, the officer corps' own standing in American society was considerably diminished, and the officer corps wished to restore that standing. The officer corps needed to make an argument that Vietnam was an anomaly, that military power still retained relevance and importance. So the officer corps is one of these groups, but others included the intellectuals that we came to call in the latter part of the 20th century, neoconservatives, the much larger group, Protestant evangelicals, who saw the 60s as a moral and cultural catastrophe. Protestant evangelicals wished to restore a traditional morality. They saw the military as representative of those traditional values that they wished to see come back into common usage.
You've also pointed out that in part this elevation of the military had a practical impetus, and that practical impetus being that we switched from a draft to a volunteer army. And to get people to volunteer, you have to make it seem an attractive option.
Oh, no question about it. I was serving in the army at that time, not in any kind of a position of influence. But as the military attempted to recover from Vietnam, the perception within the military was that the draft was a problem. The draft brought into the military people who didn't want to be there. The draft brought into the military some of the pathologies that had come to be quite prominent in American life as a result of the 1960s, whether we're talking about drug abuse or racial tensions. And so the military believed that moving to an all-volunteer force would offer a way to sort of flush out these pathologies and restore good order and discipline. Well, in an odd sense, the anti-military portions of American society became a partner in this enterprise because as a consequence of Vietnam, as a consequence of the 1960s, there was a broad rejection in American society of the conception of the citizen soldier, which had formed the foundation of American military policy for roughly the previous two centuries. And so the bargain between the anti-military portions of society and the military itself was a bargain that said, okay, we'll let citizens off the hook. There is no obligation to defend the country. We will instead create what was called an all-volunteer force, but was actually a professional military, and the professional military will be the institution that will defend the country. And for a considerable period of time, in the 90s, let's say, this seemed like a good bargain. Both sides benefited. My argument would be that after 9/11, we ought to have come to understand that this bargain actually was an insidious one, not particularly in the interest of the country.
Insidious because,
in effect, the American people forfeited control over their military. The military is not America's military, it's Washington's military. And Washington, particularly in the wake of 9/11, set out to do with the military whatever it wished to do. And the American people had remarkably little say and remarkably little control. I mean, I would point to the Iraq War as, of course, the greatest example of Washington basically taking ownership of the military and doing what it wanted to do.
Doesn't the American public now, in general, wouldn't you say, view that war as having been a mistake? You certainly view it as having been, I think you called it a, quote, catastrophic failure.
Yeah, well, it was a failure.
You think the public agrees with that?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I suspect that if we, at random grabbed 10 people on the street here in Missoula and said, hey, what do you think of the Iraq War? I doubt that any of the 10 would say, boy, it was a rousing success. Let's do that again. On the other hand, my sense would be that the American people have rather quickly actually forgotten that war. There's been remarkably little reflection. Okay, if it was a mistake, if it was a failure, what conclusions should we draw from that mistake and that failure? My argument would be that one of the things we ought to do in the wake of Iraq, in trying to understand the implications of Iraq, would be to go back and revisit that decision to jettison the tradition of the citizen soldier, to ask ourselves if for this republic, for this democracy, for this great power at this point in our history, do we want to rely on a professional military, which is not representative of our society,
do you think we should
which
go,
is divorced from our society, which empowers political elites in Washington whose perception of our role in the world may not be actually in the interests of the country.
Would the draft, in your opinion, solve that?
Well, my argument is not for the draft, but for a program of national service. And we need to distinguish between the draft and national service. The draft says that the state has the authority to command citizens to serve in the military, to select you but not you. A program of national service is somewhat larger. What that says is that every young person owes to the country and the community a term of service, and that service can take various forms. One form is that the individual can serve in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, Marine Corps, but that there would be other opportunities to serve, whether in Teach for America or the Peace Corps or a new version of the Civilian Conservation Corps, a wide variety of functions, but everybody serves. And my notion would be that a program of national service would do a couple of things for us. One, I think it would give us a military that would be, in fact, more representative of American society.
And more accountable.
Would close the gap between the military and society, and arguably would give us a military policy that was informed by greater realism and restraint than has been the case. There would be accountability. But the other thing I think a program of national service might do would be to enrich the prevailing conception of citizenship. It would make the point that citizenship does not simply entail rights, prerogatives, but it also entails obligations. And I think that we live in a time when making the point that citizenship entails obligations actually might be a good thing.
I have been speaking with Andrew Basevich. He teaches at Boston University, an author, retired Army colonel. Professor Basevich, it's been a pleasure to have you in our studio and talk about, as you call it, the new American militarism. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Andrew Basevich will give a free public lecture on the new American militarism starting tonight at 8 o'clock in the Denison Theater on the University of Montana campus.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear with some patchy fog, and lows will be in the teens. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies, some patchy fog in the morning with highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s. In central Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies and lows 25 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs 45 to 50. And in southwest Montana tonight, look for mostly clear skies with lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with highs in the 40s. And now for the editorial comments of Patricia Rosenleaf.
Rewarding the profession, melding the art with the science. Ask any teacher what he or she thinks of merit pay, and you'll probably get a shudder and a grimace at the same time. It's not that any teacher is against being paid more, but merit pay has been inextricably linked to student performance. While a layman might think that that would be fair, any person in the profession knows that such action would be anything but fair. Think of tying a farmer's worth to his crop value without taking into consideration drought, disease, or the vicissitudes of crop prices and weather conditions. No Child Left Behind is based on student performance, and we've all seen the disaster that has turned out to be, with teachers teaching to the test, cheating to get the scores higher, students being sentenced to a school experience of learning rote material and receiving little, if any, education that counts, such as how to think through a problem, solve it, find resources, and write or speak about it. The creative arts have been all but left behind. NCLB and its inherent system of student-based judging has been a fiasco from the first day. Could there be another way, though? In my mind, the quagmire of merit pay has left me rigidly against the proposition. That is, until one windy and cold autumn morning when I visited the tiny school of Centerville in the Montana North Central Outback. I had accompanied the area Montana Education Association MFT field consultant, Jerry Recavina, to this, his own family's school, We sauntered down the hall with Sue Lorang, the librarian, and Jerry brought up the fact that Centerville had a system of merit pay forged by the teachers in the union, which Jerry says, quote, is a credit to the school board, who had been encouraging such a change and had offered $3,500 as an incentive for the teachers. In subsequent meetings, first all of the teachers threw out the performance-based models they'd seen and came up with a system that works for them and for their school. Forging the agreement took the input of every teacher as they wrote descriptors which signify a professional steeped in his own profession and a successful educator. As Ruccovina states, quote, good teaching is both an art and a science. It's impossible to datify the art of teaching any more than one can quantify a great work of art. So successful has been this program, though, that the most recent amount offered by the school board has been $10,000 extra compensation. What a concept! Jerry and Susan explained that the performance-based compensation, as they prefer to call it, adopted after many hours of study and analysis, includes some 55 items which teachers self-report on throughout the year. Some of the items include field trips taken, graduate courses completed, involvement in both political and union activities, and many more. What I found genius in this endeavor was how many of the items would, and do I'm sure, serve to inspire teachers to go beyond the norm and try exciting and innovative ways of inspiring their students. Items in this area include developing new instructional units, modifying or differentiating for instruction, using crossover grade or subject matter units, inviting guest speakers, and conducting in-school as well as out-of-school field trips. Teachers are also awarded points for including student writing in classes where writing has not traditionally been part of the curriculum, using a variety of assessments, and adhering to a discipline plan. To me, the system crosses all borders of the teaching experience, from personal contributions to classroom instruction to political activity, from involvement in school activities to background and professional growth. In those categories, I found a well-thought-out and pertinent list of what goes into making a professional teacher. It does not mention class averages or attainment levels. Instead, the system encourages as much or as little as a teacher might be willing to do in the course of a year, but it also contains the seeds of inspiration to go beyond what one might have been doing, to venture out, to try something different without the fear of failure. It does what merit pay should do. It pays for meritorious teaching, not for student grades. Along with the school board, Jerry calls the community a factor in the program's success. Ruccovina claims that he's never walked into the Centerville school, which contains K through 12 grades, and felt anything but welcome, and he feels that students have the same reaction. Quote, a kid would really have to work at being lost in the shuffle in this school, end quote, Ruccovina observed. So that caring atmosphere, along with an interested and involved school board, community buy-in, and a faculty open to trying to find the answer to what makes a good teacher even better, combined to create Centerville's Performance-Based Compensation, or PVC. The system that the committee came up with is a testament to those facile minds and to the determination to make this system both equitable and yet challenging and capable of growing a teacher. Teachers often undersell their contributions because so much goes into an average day that datifying it, as Ruccovina says, is all but impossible. But with the PBC system, teachers get a profile of the work they do and the part they play in the community, their classroom, and their school. I came home from that experience in Centerville on fire to find out more about the system and to write about it. The excitement the idea engendered in me was enough to warm up that chilly morning in Montana and to shed the light of a great idea. We teachers always talk about the aha moment when an idea catches the interest, attention, and understanding of our students. We should never be immune to those moments ourselves. Performance-based compensation may be an idea whose moment has arrived. This is Pat Rosenleaf, a retired educator who will never lose interest in public education, the United States' great equalizer. Thanks for listening.
Patricia Rosenleaf is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join me tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.